We have finished with the barbaric book of Judges. I'd like to say we're finished with the barbarism. We're not. Barbarism remains an attractive feature of the early history of Israel, right down to the destruction of the first temple. So the barbarism isn't over. But what we are going to see now in the book of Samuel is the transition from anarchy to monarchy, which is the great leap forward. Before I say anything more, you can see already we're doing the first book of Samuel. Now, if you would have said to Rashi, or any of the great commentators of the Middle Ages, the first book of Samuel, they wouldn't know what you were talking about. Because originally, the so-called two books of Samuel were one. And the division into two, which we have in our Hebrew Bible, together with the chapter divisions that we have in our Hebrew Bible, together with the verse numberings which we have in our Hebrew Bible, are Christian. They are Christian. Be aware of it. If you'd have said to Rashi or to Ibn Ezra, Isaiah chapter 7 verse 14, he would not know what you were talking about. He knew the whole of Isaiah, so you gave him a quote, he knew where it was from. But the chapter division and the verse division were to him unknown. In fact, we're not sure who was responsible for it, if you're interested. One view is it was Archbishop Stephen Langton, the Archbishop of Canterbury in the Middle Ages. Others attribute it to the translator of the Bible into Latin, a gentleman called Jerome, who was the Bishop of Jerusalem in the 4th century. But how does it turn up in our text? Well, when they printed the Bible in the 16th century, the printers introduced the Christian chapter division and verse numberings, and they are here to stay. But let's face it, it's convenient. You know, this is, that we need it for such. It was suggested that one of the reasons why it did appear among the Jews was because of the disputations in Spain in the Middle Ages, where you had the priests against the rabbis, and the priests were talking about Exodus chapter 3 verse 4, and they didn't have an Exodus chapter 3 verse 4. So it became a necessity. In any event, they're here, and in any event, a number of them run contrary to Jewish tradition. In fact, a number of them are anti-Jewish. So there's a thought that we might discuss another time. The two books of Samuel relate to three major personalities, three fascinating personalities, all of whom share a common factor. And that common factor is tragedy. Samuel, as we shall see, the great prophet Samuel, the second Moses, is a tragic figure. Saul is a tragic figure of the classical Homeric dimensions. I mean, he is a contemporary of the War of Troy. And if you would lift him from the Hebrew Bible into Greek tradition, he'd fit in very well with the other Homeric tragic heroes, as we shall see, I hope, in due course. And then there's King David. Now, what can be tragic about David? After all, he is the mighty king. He creates the kingdom of Israel. He creates Jerusalem. Look what he only achieved. And yet his personal life was a tragedy. To no small extent, it was his own making. But that, again, we may ultimately see. So that sets you in the picture for what we're going to do. So let's start the text. It's right-hand side of the first page. Again, we are using the text of the Bible Society. Vayhi ish echad min haramatayim. Now, there was a certain man for a number of time. Normally you have the singular form Rama. Ramatayim is a dual form, the upper heights, whatever it may mean. Sofim, now Sofer normally means a watchman. But not here. Sofim, this is their family, their clan name. Mehar Ephraim from the territory of Ephraim. Ushmo Elkanah ben Yerocham ben Elihu ben Tohu. Oh, we've got four generations, somebody said. Well, they notch these things up. They like to know where they came from. They kept this information. Ben Suf, the son of Tzuf, Ephrati. Now, what does Ephrati mean? The most obvious is to say he comes from, well, the normal explanation is that since he's living in the territory of Ephraim, he's an Ephraimite. That's the normal explanation. But we know he's not an Ephraimite. Why? How do I know he's not an Ephraimite? He's a Levi. And his son is a Levi. And will officiate and function as a Levi, though he's not yet born. So what is Ephrat? What is Ephrati? And you've suggested, my friend, from the word Ephrat. But where is Ephrat? I mean, we know where the modern Ephrat is, but where was the original biblical Ephrat? Don't know, do you? Kick yourselves.
Euphrates, the river?
No. It was Bethlehem.
Right.
Bethlehem. It was the alternative, and I suspect the older name. Because Bethlehem means battlefield, so before it became a battle site, no doubt at the time of the conquest, its name was Ephrat. And it's mentioned in the Book of Ruth as an alternative name to Bethlehem. So I've got a man who is a Bethlehemite. We've already met other Bethlehemites, haven't we? Our Levi, and of course Ruth and Boaz. Now let's do a little bit of imagination here. He is a Bethlehemite. He's going to have a son, Samuel. Samuel will anoint David. And when Samuel anoints David, he will be old enough to be his grandfather. Yeah, so Samuel to David is three generations. Go back to Samuel's daddy, that's four generations. You know that David is fourth generation after Boaz. Which means that Elkanah, our friend here, from Bethlehem in Judah, is of the same generation as Boaz and Ruth. They may have passed each other in the street doing their shopping. Isn't that an interesting point? You know, you have to be aware of these subtleties. Okay.
But he's got a terrible name.
Who, Elkanah?
No. Ben Tohu.
Oh yes. Yeah. No, Tohu is not Tohu. Tohu is not is void. Tohu is not there. Yeah. So, still, I mean, I don't know what. Let's put it. I don't know what they would have called him for short. Well, Lo Shtei Nashim. He has two wives. There's nothing unusual in having two wives, and certainly in no way against the legislation of the Torah. Shema Achat Chana, the one is called Chana. Veshema Shinit Penina, and the second is called Penina. Vayihi Lifnina Yeladim Ulechana Ein Yeladim. Now Penina had children and Chana didn't. This might be by way of explanation as to why he has two wives. His first wife could not bear him children, therefore he takes on board a second one. Fair enough, let's see how it continues. And that man would go up from his city from year to year. We've had this phrase, haven't we, at the end of the book of Judges. Miyamim Yamima, there was a festival at Shiloh. Miyam Yamima, on an annual basis. And I suspected that because this phrase is used in connection with the festival of Pesach, it might be Pesach. Just a guess, can't prove it. And every year he went up. Lehishtachavot, to prostrate himself, lizboach l'Adonai, to sacrifice to the Lord, Tzvaot of hosts, b'Shiloh, at Shiloh, where the young ladies came out to dance to be kidnapped by the Benjamites. Okay, so we're in familiar territory, Bethlehem, Judah, Shiloh. V'Shom, and there, Shnei b'nei Eli, were the two sons of Eli, Chofni uFinchas, Chofni and Pinchas, Kohanim l'Adonai, priest to the Lord. We're being introduced to these two characters because they're going to figure later on. I will say no more than that at this stage. But I do have to say something about Eli. And in order to do so, I've got to pause for a moment and give you a little bit of historical background about the priestly family. First high priest is Aaron. Aaron has four sons. Nadav Avihu offer up an unwanted sacrifice and are incinerated. That leaves Elazar and Itamar. Elazar assumes the role of the successor to his father, and he becomes high priest, and his son after him becomes high priest, Pinchas. And we met Pinchas in that role at the end of the book of Judges, where at Beit El, with the Ark of the Lord. However, the remaining son, Itamar, didn't give up on this. He becomes a rival priest at the sanctuary of Shiloh. So we've got two rival priesthoods going on here. And Itamar is the ancestor of Eli. Eli is of that family. Now, by the time we meet him, the Ark of the Covenant is now at Shiloh and no longer at Beit El. How, what, why, I don't know. But it did move around. So you've got this dichotomy. You've got this rivalry between the two sons of, or two grandsons, two sons of Aaron. Eventually, it would be resolved by King Solomon. When he built his temple, he has a choice of candidates. Evyatar, the descendant of Eli, or Sadok, the descendant of Elazar. And he chooses Sadok, Zadok, the priest, who becomes the ancestor of all subsequent generations of priests during the first temple period. Don't like to overburden you with information, but I think it's necessary, you know, put it in context. Was that clear? Anyone want to push me on that? Okay, good, so let's pursue the text. Vayihi hayom, and it was on the day, Vayizbach Elkanah, that Elkanah offered up his sacrifice, V'natan lifnina ishto l'chol baneha uvenoteh manot. And he gives to Penina his wife and to all her children and all her sons and daughters their portions. Ulechana, and to Chana yitei mana achat apayim. Normally translated, he gave her a double portion. Because she has no one. She's sitting there with her one sandwich. So he gives her a double portion. Why? And this is revealed now. Ki et Chana ahev. Because he loved Chana. Vadunai sagar rachma. But the Lord had shut up her womb. And this is important information. Of course, he loved Chana, that's why he married her in the first place. And when she couldn't produce children, so he takes the other woman. And I've got the perfect recipe now for dissension in the house. Chana will be, well, I won't use so strong a word, she will be envious, all right? She will be envious of Penina, because Penina has children she hasn't. And Penina will be resentful because she knows her husband loves Chana and she takes second place in his affections. Perfect recipe for trouble, isn't it? And there's trouble. Vechiasata tsarata, and her adversary, we're calling Penina the adversary of Chana, they are not friends, would provoke her gamka sorely. Bavu harima, in order to make her shout out to thunder. Kisagara dunai bad brahma, the Lord had closed her womb. Takes every opportunity to provoke her, make fun of her, to flaunt her children, and to write her off. Because in that world, and indeed in the Middle East to this day, childlessness is a curse. And so Hannah is perturbed. The rabbis put a pleasant spin on it. She was doing this purposely to make her pray. Until that point, Hannah is silent. And we shall see, she will be driven in desperation to prayer. V'chein yaseh shana b'shana, and so it would be every year, midday alota b'veit Adonai, whenever she went up into the house of the Lord, Kain tachisena, she would make her life a misery. Vativke, and she would weep below tochal and couldn't eat. Vayomelach Elkanah isha, and Elkanah her husband says to her, Chana, Chana, lame tivki, why are you crying? Belame lo tochi, why don't you eat? Belame yer alavavich, why are you so upset? He knows darn well why she's upset. That's not the point. He's comforting her. He's saying, why on earth are you so upset and crying when you know that I am better to you than 10 sons? You have me, undivided. I'm absolutely devoted to you. So why are you eating your heart out? If I would reject you because of your childlessness, you'd have cause for complaint. As it is, you know, I love you. Well, it's comfort, but it's not enough. And of course, we may ask the obvious question, to which I don't have an obvious answer. He can see what's going on between the women folk there. Why doesn't he do anything to stop it? I'm not sure why. I'm afraid it's a question I cannot readily answer.
Shalom bayit.
A shalom bayit, yes, but there isn't shalom bayit. These two are fighting like cat and dog. So
he doesn't want to exacerbate.
Maybe he doesn't want to get caught up in that. You know, there may be a certain element of unwillingness. I don't want to get tied up in the women's with the women's war. It could be. You know, it's discretion is the better part of valor. Vatakum Chana achare ochla b'shilo. And Hannah arose after the eating at Shiloh. Not she yet, she didn't eat anything. After the eating at Shiloh. Vachre Shatoh, and after the drinking. No, that's after the feasting. Because they were there for a religious ceremony. They would have eaten part of the sacrifices. Ve'eli ha'kohen yosheva lakiseh. And Eli the high priest was sitting there upon his throne and his chair. Amuzuzah teichel Adonai, by the doorpost of the house of the Lord. Now what's he doing sitting up there? And it's quite a high chair too. He's keeping an eye on things. I'll say at this stage, supervising. But we may discover he had good reason to keep an eye on things, because things weren't what they should be. Vehimarat nafesh, and she was intensely bitter. Vatitpalel al Adonai, and she prayed to the Lord. Uvachotifka, and she wept sorely. Notice, vatitpalel al Adonai, should have said El Adonai, too. And the rabbis step in here saying that she didn't pray asking, she complained against God. She said, why have you done this to me? You create every creature for a purpose. And the rabbis put it beautifully. You've given me a womb, you've given me breath, so why haven't you given me children? And that's a very nice idea. It's not the plain meaning of the text, but it's an attractive one. Vatido nede batoman. She swore an oath and said, Adonai Tzvaot, Lord of hosts, Imra otira b'ani amatecha. If you will indeed look upon the misery, the affliction of your handmaiden, uzchartani, and remember me, v'lo tishkachet amatecha, not forget your handmaiden, and you will give your handmaiden a male child. I will give him to the Lord for the rest of his life. And no razor shall pass over his head. He will be a Nazarite from birth.
How do you translate that?
Seed of men.
I know.
So seed of men?
Seed. Now, what we assume what she's asking for is a male child. I want a seed that will be male. She wants a son. Unatativ, and I will give him to the Lord. As a daughter, she can't give him to the Lord. What's she going to do there in the temple when we did not officiate at the temple? Now, who does this remind you of? Being dedicated from birth?
Samson.
Who is also a Nazarite. But there is an important difference here, if you note. Whereas Samson's mummy, of unknown name, has an annunciation, an angel appears to her and gives her the glad tidings, you're going to give birth to a saviour, and he'll belong to the Lord. Poor old Hannah doesn't get that. And one may wonder why. Because quite clearly, since we've read the book, even if we haven't seen the film, we know that her child is intended to belong to God and to have a great future, and yet God doesn't do it. And I suspect, I can only offer you my theory here. Samson was dedicated to God, but who did he stay with until he got married? His parents. He grew up with them. We all know what's going to happen to Samuel, don't we? He'll be 2 years old, and his mother must surrender him. This she has to do of her volition. God will not take him away. Part of this arrangement is that she will surrender her child to God.
What does that action mean?
We'll see. It's part of the Samuel tragedy. Wait and see. We should get there this evening. Vaya, ki hir batalit palelif nadunai. And it happened as she was praying before the Lord, for Eli shomet pia, Eli sitting on his chair there observes her mouth. Hannah was praying to herself silently. Only her lips were moving. Her voice could not be heard. So Eli assumed she was drunk. Let that sink in. What was the sanctuary for? To pray. Eli sees somebody praying and it doesn't occur to him before. What's his first thought? She's drunk. What does that tell me about the situation in the sanctuary at that time? See the inference. Oh, I see somebody with their lips moving and shaking backwards and forwards. They're davening. It seems in the context of Eli's Shiloh, I see somebody like that. My first thought is, must be boozed. And she comes back. And she answers back. Vayome Eleha Eli. And Eli says to her, Oh, Madmatai Tishtakarin, how long are you going to be drunk? Hasiri et yenech me'alaych, put away your wine. Very, very abrupt. Va'atan chana batomer, and Tan chana answers and says, Lo Adoni, no my lord. Ishakashat ruach anochi, I am a woman of deep, deep distress. I haven't touched a drop of wine or strong drink. I'm pouring out my soul before the Lord, and you're branding me as a drunkard? Do not set your handmaiden, literally, before the daughter of ungodliness. Normally it's translated to mean, do not regard your servant as being an ungodly woman. That is not what the Hebrew text says. She knows, this poor woman, that she's got her adversary there, Peninnah, who's making her life a misery anyway. Now to be publicly told off by the high priest is exposing her to even more contempt. So she says to him, do not set me before that ungodly woman to give her more opportunity to make my life a misery. Because I was speaking from that up till now from the depths of my complaint and my vexation. So she really has put him in this place, hasn't she? And so Eli responds and says, Lechi l'shalom, go in peace. Ve'lo ha'Yisrael yitein et she'lateich asher sha'alt me'imo. And this can be translated in two quite different ways. You see, in English, as in other Western languages, you have a distinction between the indicative, he will do something, and the subjunctive, he may do something. In Hebrew, I've only got the one form, yitein. Now, yitein may mean he will give, or yitein may mean
may
he give. And so I can translate it as a prayer. Yitein et she'lateich asher sha'alt me'imo. May he grant your request that you have made of him. In which case, he's blessing her. Alternatively, he may actually be saying, he will answer your prayer. At that moment, Eli has a prophetic insight. Which is it? Well, there's no doubt as to how Hannah took it. Vatomer, and she answers, she says, Timsa, Shivchatcha chen be'enecha, let your handmaiden find favor in your eyes. Vatelecha ishala darkan, and so the woman went about her business. Vatochal, and she ate. Ufaneha lo hayu la'ot, and she no longer had a sad countenance. Why not? Because she's had a blessing, or because she believes she has had a prediction? You see the point?
Yeah.
She takes it as a prediction, and with good reason. Vayashkim b'boker, they got up early the next morning. Vayishtachavu lifnei Adonai, and they bowed down before the Lord. Vayashuvu, and they returned. Vayavoe beitam aramata, they came back to their home in Ramah. Vayeda Elkana et Chana ishto, and Elkana had carnal knowledge of Hannah his wife. They had their usual family relationships. Vayizkareha Adonai, and the Lord remembered her. Vayhili tekufot hayamim, and it came to pass with the passage of the seasons. Vatah Hannah, that Hannah became pregnant. Vatelid bein, and she gave birth to a son. Vatikra et shemo Shemuel, and she called him Shemuel. Ki me Adonai shilti, because I have asked of him from the Lord. 2 points here. What does the name Shemuel actually mean?
God heard.
Now that's what it's normally, God heard. But that isn't correct. Because to hear is Shin Mem Ayin. And you would have to pronounce that Ayin. Mm-hmm. So it's not Shemuel.
It's from Sam.
No, I'll tell you. I don't want to burden you too much with grammar, but let me give you a slight insight. Hebrew as we have it today, and certainly as it was in biblical times, did not have, or have showed, does not exhibit too many case endings. But there was a point in the development of the Hebrew language, as in classical Arabic, you had case endings. And the nominative form ended in an oo. So Shemu was the nominative form of name. Masu was a man, hence Masu Shelach. Penu was a faith, hence Penuel. So she gives him a name, Shemuel, name for God. I designate him for God. Kibbe Hashem Shelti, because I asked him for the Lord. But there's another point which you could pass over very easily. Who normally gives names to children, mummies or daddies? It's the fathers. It doesn't say here, and he called his name Shemuel. She gives him the name. Her prerogative. She asked for this child. Her request has been granted. She named him. Little point, a subtle one. We have to be aware of this.
Yitzchak was named by his mother.
Yes. Yeah, well, she laughed. She had the last laugh. Vayala ishel kanava chol beitol izbach ladunai. And so Elkanah and his household went up to sacrifice to the Lord, Zevach HaYamim, the seasonal sacrifices, for Et Nidro, and to offer up his vow. Now, when you made a vow, what did you vow? I vow to bring a sacrifice. It's not the vow of Hannah here. We must suspect that when the baby was born, what did he do? What did Elkanah do? He vowed to bring a sacrifice to God in gratitude. So he's going up to bear his sacrifice of gratitude. What about Hannah? V'chana lo alata. Hannah did not go up. Ki amarali isha, because she said to her husband, al yigamel anar. Wait until the boy is weaned. He still needs his mummy. V'aviotiv, and I will bring him. V'nir'ah et panei Adonai, and he will appear before the Lord. V'yashav sham adulam, and will remain there forever.
So did his other wife also go up?
Oh yes. She went up with her children, yeah, together with Elkanah, and Hannah remains behind. But she knows the day must come when she will go up with her son and come home on her own. I said the element of tragedy. So we'll come back to that in a moment. What does her husband say? Well, Yomela Elkanah, Elkanah says to her, Elkanah Isha, her husband Elkanah, Asi Hatobenoich, do what you think is best. Shuvi ad gomleich, here, stay here until you've weaned him, or go to. Ach Yakem Adunai Devaro, but let God fulfill his word. Now he should have said, you should keep your word. Why did he say, let God fulfill his word?
That he'll survive.
Pardon?
That the child will survive.
No.
That he'll accept him.
Well, yes and no. She asked for this child, and he would be then returned to God. God has granted this wish, and therefore they suspect that God has a purpose for this child. And so he says to her, I know you'd love to keep him, but you do have to bring him so that God can fulfill his purpose for this boy. They don't know what it is yet, but they know it is. Vateshev ha'isha vatenek et banan. So the woman remained and suckled her son at gomlahoto until she had weaned him. And then Vatalehu ima, she took him up with her, Kashegamalatu, once she had weaned him, Befarim Shalosha, with three oxen, Ve'efah Achat Kemach, and an ephah of flour, Ve'nevel Yain, and a skin of wine, her offerings, three offerings, the meat, the flour offering, the wine offering.
And but the others were still there?
No, this is already some time after. This was not a regular visit. This was when the child had been weaned. That was her agreement. But Vayehu Beit Adonai Shiloh, and she took him up to the house of the Lord at Shiloh. Vahana'a, he was a very little boy. 2 years old. 2 years old. Vayishchatu et hapar, and they sacrificed the ox. Vayaviu et ha'anah le'eli, and they brought the boy to Eli. Vatomer, and she says, Be Aduni, I beg you, my Lord, chein afshecha, as your soul lives, Aduni, my Lord, ani ha'isha nitzevet imecha bazeh, I was the woman who stood here with you, litpalel Adonai, to pray to the Lord, elana zeh itpalalti, I prayed for this boy, vayiten Adonai li et sheilati, God granted me my wish, asher sha'alti me'emo, which I asked of him. And now, v'gamanochi hishiltihu ladunai. I now literally loan him. I now dedicate him to the Lord. Kol hayamim asher haya, as long as he shall live, hu sha'u ladunai, he is dedicated to the Lord. Vayishtachu sham ladunai, and he, the little boy, bows down there to the Lord. She has kept her word. Now, we can imagine what it was like for Hannah to go away and leave her beloved child. I mean, it's a tearjerker. What was it like for Samuel? For Samuel, but he finds himself, mummy is not there, and he's left in this big place. And wait, we'll see what he's left among. This was no sacred location. So what does that do to a two-year-old child who out of nowhere is deserted by his parents?
It traumatizes
him. Samuel has tragedy. Here the tragedy begins. But that's part of the test, because he's got to grow into something and someone very special. Now, there's a famous prayer of Hannah, which I don't propose to read with you, because I'm more interested with the narrative. So if you come over to sheet 2, and it's verse 11. It's a lovely, lovely song, but let's stick to the narrative. I have reason for that. Verse 11, can you see it? Vayelech Elkanah haramata al beito. And after this, Elkanah goes back home to Ramah. Vanah hayimasharet et Adonai et pnei Eli kohen. And the child was now serving the Lord before Eli the priest. He has become his little apprentice. Only he won't get fired. Now comes the information we'd rather not read. Uvenei Eli b'nei Belial. Now, Eli's two sons were a pair of villains. They were godless men. Lo yadu etam. They did. Normally, they did not know the Lord. Well, of course, they knew the Lord. Yada has a secondary meaning, to acknowledge. They didn't acknowledge God. Umishpata kohanim etam. And the practice of the priests with the people was as follows. Not the practice of the priests that was ordained by the Torah, heaven forfend. This is something that they'd introduced themselves. Kol ish zoveach zevach, whenever a man would offer up a sacrifice, uvahanara kohen, vah kohen kvashel abasar, and the priest's boy or young man would come as the flesh was cooking, vahamazleik shalosh shenayim biyado, with a three-pronged fork in his hand. Vahikab bakiyor uvadud ubakalachat ubaparul, they're all terms for cauldrons, pots. The young man would stick the fork into the cauldron or the pot or the kettle or what have you. Kola sheyale b'mazleik, whatever was in, caught by the fork, yikach ha-kohen bo, the priest would take it, helping himself. Kacha yasu l'chol yisrael, and this is what they were doing to all the people of Israel, habayim sham b'shilo, who came up to Shilo. This was unsanctioned. It was unlawful. Even worse, gam beterim yaktinu et achelev, before they even had a chance to offer up that fat which covers the kidneys that you had to offer up on the altar, and which to this day a Jew may not eat, it's called suet. Uva na kohen, the priest, the young man, would come v'amal isha zoveach and say to the man offering the sacrifice, tanavasar, give meat, litzlot lakohen, for the high priest to roast. Lo yikach mimcha basar v'mevushal, he will not accept from you cooked meat, ki imcha, it's got to be raw. Vayom elav ha'ish. And the man would say to him, kate yaktirun kayom achelev, wait till they've offered up the sacrificial fat, at least let's perform the sacrifice. But kach lecha, then take what you want, kolah she'tavei nafshecha, whatever you desire. V'yamar, but the young man replied to him, lo, not lamad vav, got to read it lamad aleph, lo, no, ki ata titein, you will give it to me now, v'im lo, and if you won't, lakachti b'choska, I'll take it by force. Therefore, the sin of these young men was great before the Lord. Because people were beginning to hold the sacrifices in contempt. If the priest, who was supposed to be regulating the sanctity of the temple, who was supposed to be supervising the sacrifices, are coming like thieves to take away the meat that should belong to God, why should we bother? If they hold it in contempt, what should we do? In the meantime, who's growing? Who is in the midst of this knavery?
Samuel.
Little Samuel. Is he going to be affected by it? No. Ushmuel masharet et pnei Adonai. In the meantime, Samuel was serving before the Lord. Nar, a boy, chagur eifod bad, wearing the ephod of linen.
Why
he's in the midst
these guys
of
it. Thrown out?
Pardon?
Why weren't they thrown out?
Wait. Leave it to God to sort these things out. Wait, your question is entirely valid. Entirely valid. But you
takes its course.
Yeah, you've got to wait and see. There is another question that comes ahead of it. But it will be, all will be revealed. We still have time. The little boy is serving in the midst of that lot. Is it affecting him? Is it infecting him?
But how can't it not influence him?
That's the point. How can it not influence him? And it doesn't. It doesn't. We shall see. It doesn't. So that tells me something about the nature of this child. He is God's child.
He is what?
He is God's child. God sent him into the world for his purpose. And therefore, therefore this boy will grow up with a developing immunity. So here's a boy who has the trauma of being isolated from his parents, the trauma of growing up in a sacred place among villains. But this is going to be the making of the man, not the destruction of the boy. Umi'il, once again, tearjerker. The author here knows how to introduce those little human moments. Umi'il katon ta'aseloimo. And his mummy used to make him a little tunic. Ba'alta lo miyamim yamima. And she would bring it up to him every year. Ba'alota etisha lizbarach et zebach hayamim. When she would go up with her husband to offer up the seasonal sacrifice. She has a little boy, she knows he's there, and all she can do for him is knit him a jumper. And it's that me'il, that tunic, is going to become, as we shall see, the trademark of Samuel. But no more of it now. Uveilach Eli et Elkanah v'et ishto, and Eli blessed Elkanah and his wife. Yamar, and he said, Yaseim Adonai lechazera min ha'isha hazot, may the Lord grant you progeny from this woman. Tachat ha'sheila asher sha'al Adonai, in place of that which you dedicated to the Lord. V'alchu limkomo, and they went back to their home. Ki fakad Adonai et Chana, for the Lord visited Chana. Bataha, and she conceived. Batelet, and she gave birth Shloshavanim to three sons, Ushtevanot, and two daughters. In the meantime, the style. Vayigdal Hana Shmuel Madunai. In the meantime, Samuel was growing up with God. He's in that den there of iniquity. But what's happening to him? He is resistant. He's growing up with the Lord.
But there's no reflection on the chief rabbi, for want of a better term. forget his name.
Ailey.
Yeah.
You've in fact asked what should have been the first question. You see, your question was, you know, what is God doing about it? The question that has to come before that is, what's their father doing about it? Well, you're going to be answered immediately. But Eli Zakemiel, now Eli was exceptionally, was very old. V'shama, and he heard et kol asher ya'asum banav l'kol Yisrael, what his sons were doing to the Israelites. And how they were bedding the married women who were assembling around the entrance to the tent of assembly. So it wasn't just the meat they were pinching, they were after other flesh.
Good job.
Pardon?
They did a good job.
They regarded it as their perks. By Yom Elahem, and he said to them, Lamatasun Kadabarim Aile, why are you doing such things? Ashao Nochi Shomea, which I hear at Divrechem Raim, your terrible deeds, Meet Kolam Aile, from all the people? Al Banai, no, my sons, Kilo Tova Hashmua Ashao Nochi Shomea, because the report I hear, Ma'avinim Amadunai, being passed around by the people of the Lord, is not good. Do you regard that as a strong rebuke? It isn't. It's a slap on the wrist.
That's right.
He should have been reading them the Riot Act. Instead of which, he does give them a warning. Im yechete ish leish, if one man wrongs another, ufile lo Elohim, then God can act as judge. He can mediate between the two. V'im ladunai yechete ish, but if a man wrongs God, Mi yitpalel lo, who will intercede to act as judge between them? Who's going to attempt to judge a case where God is one of the litigants? In other words, my boys, you've had it. Velo yishmu, they did not listen the kol avihen to their father's voice. Why were they deaf? Ki chafetz adonai lahamitam, because it was God's intention to kill them. There was, for what they had done, there was no opportunity to repent. They had disgraced and degraded the sanctuary in the vilest of ways. For that, extirpation.
Can you just give us a side bit about the root, pei, lamed, lamed?
Yes, I will. Can I just finish to the end of the paragraph? Because once again, in the midst of all this, what is happening, we're being reminded of it, that the author is using his stylistic approach. We don't lose sight of a little boy. In the meantime, Samuel was growing up great and good. Gam im Adonai, gam im Anashim, both with the Lord and with man. He was creating a good opinion of himself, both with God and with human beings. You'll find favour in the eyes of the Lord and man, and this is precisely what he was doing. The verb palal means to think, to deliberate. Right? That's its basic meaning. Hence, one form of deliberation is tefillah, prayer. But palal can also mean to deliberate in a judicial sense. For oyveinu plilim, our enemies are our judges. So that's how it's being used.
Right.
Okay. May I move you on? We've agreed that the slap on the wrist was not adequate. And indeed, how is Eli getting away with it? And the answer is, he isn't. Vayavo ish Elohim el Eli. And the man of God comes to Eli. When he says to him, Ko amadunai, thus says the Lord, Ha niglo nigleti el beit avicha, biyotam b'mitzrayim, levet paro. I most certainly did I not reveal myself to your father in the land of Egypt when you were serving Pharaoh. And indeed he did. Because we know in chapter 4 of Shemot, God does speak to Aaron. Not only Moses he addresses, he speaks to Aaron too. So did I not reveal myself to him? Uvachor oto mikol shibtei Yisrael ilekohen? And did I not choose him from all the tribes of Israel to be my priest? La'alot al mizbechi, to offer up sacrifices upon my altar. La'aktir ketoret, to offer up the incense. La'aseit efod lefanai, to carry the ephod before me. And I hand it over to your father, I delegate it to him, all the burnt offerings of the children of Israel. Therefore, lama tova'atu bezivchi u'minchati asher tziviti ma'on. Why are you kicking against? Not just your sons, he's including him now in the crime. Why are you kicking against my sacrifices and my meal offerings which I have commanded for my sanctuary? V'techabed et banecha mimeni, you're showing more honour to your children than to me. Lahavriachem, to make yourselves fat, mereshit kol minchat Yisrael la'ami, from the best of the offerings of my people Israel. He says, you're making yourselves fat. He doesn't say they're making themselves fat. He's including Eli in the ill-gotten gain. Clearly, Daddy was not only turning a blind eye, but he was enjoying the salt beef sandwich too. To put it in modern parlance. Lachein yom Adonai Elohi Yisrael. Therefore, thus says the Lord of God of Israel. Amor amarti beitcha uveit avicha yitalchu lefanai ad olam. I had indeed intended that your house and the house of your father should walk before me until the end of time. i.e. you and your descendants would have been my high priests. Ve'ata, but now, Neumadunai, says the Lord, Chalilali. Normally translated as, far be it from me. That is what I call a weak T translation. Chalel is to profane. Chalilami means it would be a profanation for me. Ki machabdai achabed, for I will honour those who honour me. Uvozai, and those who hold me in contempt, yekalu, they shall be lightly esteemed. Hine yamim baim, therefore the day will come. Vegadati etzroacha, that I will cut off your arm. Vezroa beit avich, and the arm of your father's house. Mi yodzakein beveitecha, so that there will be no old people in your house. Nobody's going to grow old among your descendants. They're all going to die young. And of course, the imagery is very, very potent here. You see, if a priest suffers from any kind of physical damage, the loss of one of his irreplaceable limbs, he can no longer officiate. So I'm going to cut your arm off. But by the same token, one of the parts of meat from an offering which was designated to the priest was the zeroa, the arm of the animal. And he said, I'm going to cut it off. You're going to lose it all. Ve'ish lo achrit lecha meim mezbechi. However, I will not cut off every male descendant of yours from my altar. Lechalot et einecha, to make your eyes go weak. Uladiv et nafshecha, and to make your soul sick. V'chol ma'bit beitecha yamutu anashim. But all the increase of your house will die young men. Now, that's one way of interpreting it, but there is an alternative one which I prefer, which is even worse. He says to him, I will not cut off your every male member from my altar. No, on the contrary, I want you to have male descendants. Lechalot et einecha, to make your eyes grow weak. V'ladiv et nafshecha, and to trouble your soul. V'chol ma'bit beitecha yamutu anashim, when all the members of your household die in their prime of life. So this is
very harsh.
Let the punishment fit the crime. You were the high priest. It was your duty to prevent this from happening. You not only did you not prevent it, you became a party to it. And since you became a party to it, you are worse than them. And you know, this is precisely what Rambam says. You know, this becomes crystallized into Jewish law. I digress for a moment because I think it has some interest. If you see people doing something wrong, you have to stop them. You have a duty to say, don't do this, you're harming yourself. You don't grab hold of them at the kiddush and shout at them in front of everybody. You take them quietly on one side. If, however, you're a person in authority, and you see that people are doing wrong, and you refrain from saying anything. You know, once again, discretion is the better part of valor. Says Rambam, when punishment comes upon them, it's going to hit you too. Because you were in a position to do something, and you did nothing.
And if you're in a position to do something, and you do it, and it has no effect,
then you've at least done your bit. You've done your bit. But for those in a position of leadership to sit quiet, you know, we'll do things behind the scenes. To sit quiet, unacceptable. There comes a moment when your voice has to be heard, even if no one is listening to you. And so Eli is guilty, as guilty, if not more guilty, than his sons. V'zelechaot! And this is the sign. I'm giving you a sign to know that my words will be fulfilled. Asher yavo el shnei banecha el Chofni u'Pinchas, of that which is going to come upon your two sons, Chofni and Pinchas. B'yom achad yemutu shnei, the two of them will die on one day. So when you hear that, you know that the punishment has begun. Vakamotili kohinerman. However, I will establish for me a loyal, truthful, reliable priest. Kashebil vaviu nafshiyase, will act in accordance with my thoughts and my wishes. Uvanikilo baik neerman, and I will build for him a faithful, a permanent house. Vehithalech lifnei shichi kol hayamim, and he shall walk before my anointed one for the rest of time. And I'll have to come back to this in a moment. Vayakol anotar beveitecha, but all those who remain of your house, yavol hishtachavot lo, will have to come and bow down to him. La gorat kesef, for a 5 pence piece, who will kick alachim in a roll. V'amar, and he will have to say, Sefachenina, please attach me elachatakunot, to one of the priestly watches, le'echol pat lechem, so that I can at least eat a morsel of bread. They will be reduced to penury and begging. That's what you brought upon your family. But there's one expression there that makes us sit up. Makes us sit up for a good reason. He suddenly says, before my anointed one. There ain't no anointed one.
Yet.
Not yet.
Yet.
Not yet. So what is the Lord telling Eli? There will be a king.
Yeah.
There's going to be a king. But you'll not have any pleasure from it. You'll not derive any benefit from it. Because when the king will be there, your rival family, the family of Elazar, the family of Tzadok, will be the priests. They will officiate before the king of Israel. So I want you to know that. But of course, we know something else.
How did this work? They're all Kohanim, aren't they?
Yeah.
Are they cousins?
Oh yes, yes, I did point this out. You've got the two branches of a family. You have the family of Elazar and Pinchas and the family of Itamar. And Elazar was functioning at Beit El, the family of Elazar, and the family of Pinchas was functioning at Shiloh, but Shiloh was destined to be destroyed. I won't say more than that at present. But of course we know something else. He has indicated to the man that he has condemned to extirpation, there will be a king. But what Eli doesn't know is the kingmaker is already in place.
Is Samuel the first king of Israel?
No, he's the kingmaker.
He's the king.
Oh, right.
He's the king, mate. Please do.
In verse 27,
yeah,
it says, and a man of God came to Eli.
Yeah.
Who was the man of God?
We do not know. It's a very valid question. More than once in the Bible, a nameless prophet emerges.
Yeah.
What we must understand is that although we don't get too many references to prophecy was there. In the form of a prophet and his school, we will meet the entity, the Bnei Anavim, the sons of the prophets. Who were the Bnei Anavim? A prophet would have, and I use the term, a yeshiva. He would have his school where young men would come, would study the law of Moses. Because how was the law of God being transmitted at this time? Clearly, Eli at Shiloh wasn't doing very much. It was the prophetic teachers who were teaching the law. We say this. Moshe kibbutz Torah mi Sinai. Moses received the law from Sinai. Masara, Ushua, handed it over to Joshua. Joshua handed it over to Zakanim, to the elders. Zakanim Linavim. The prophets are the transmitters of the law. And they would have their circle, Bnei Anavim, who would study with the prophet. And the point may come where the prophet may send one of these young men to act as emissary. Go tell. Elijah will do it. Elisha will do it. Go tell. Go anoint someone as king. This unknown man has been sent by God or sent by his prophetic master to carry the doomsday message to Eli. And what does Eli answer? Nothing. There is no answer. He has to accept the word of God because he cannot escape from the reality of what he has done. Moral of story, don't play games with God, because he's not only the winning team, he's also the ref.
How does this period under Samson dates? How
no idea where Samson, I cannot begin to tell you where he is in all this. You see, Samson may be earlier than this, we don't know. The author of the book of Judges does not work on a consecutive fashion. We're given stories that could be same period, before, after, which one came first, we're not always sure. I've tried to link up by tracing generations that Elkanah is probably contemporary with Ruth and Boaz, and if I make that assumption, then we can see that the book here is assuming the shorter period of the judgment. Remember I told you there are two views on the period of the judges. One says the period of the judges was 400 years, another says no, maybe 150 years. This seems to tie in with the shorter period of the judges. But a lot of it is guesswork. Did you find this informative?
Yes.
It's quite a story, isn't it?
Yeah.
Can we guess how old was Hannah when she gave birth?
No idea. No idea.
The beginning of the conscious, so
well, some of it will get better. That's the nicest thing I can say. Some of it will get better, but remember, amid this horror, something is evolving. A leader is evolving. A change of regime will evolve, and we will point towards a monarchy. And a monarch who will live in eternity, who will be eternal, because he will be the ancestor of the Messiah. And who is going to play the crucial role? The little boy who is impervious to sin, who is bereft of his parents, who knows he has to give his life to God, and he ain't going to get much out of it. So we will see more of the tragedy of Samuel in due course. Okay, that's I think enough for one session. Well, you may have guessed I love the biblical narrative, and you can see why. I'm not creating the powerful story. This text, which is nearly 3,000 years old, is creating the powerful story.
Would this be about 400 years after the Exodus?
It could be. Sandy, you see, that's the whole point. We're either talking of 200 or 400, thereabout. Those are the two possible datings for the period of the Judges. Did it last for 200 years or 400 years? Can't say. Well, Shabbat Shalom, and I look forward to seeing you next week.